Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, you'll hear Seth's interview with Lizzie Goodman, author of Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City. She also answers a few more questions backstage for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump and his supporters are lashing out over the special counsel investigation into his team's ties to Russia. And strangely, Trump and his own lawyers can't even seem to agree on whether he's actually being investigated. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump's presidency has obviously been consumed by the Russia scandal, so on Friday, he seemed positively giddy to get out of D.C. and travel to Florida, where he announced new executive action rolling back President Obama's policies on Cuba. Because, of course, we all remember those forgotten men and women of the working class who flocked to Trump rallies and enthusiastically chanted their famous slogan, "Please make it harder for us to go to Cuba." Nonetheless, Trump seemed excited to be talking about anything other than the investigation consuming his administration, and that excitement showed in the way he pronounced Little Havana.
I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana. I want to thank Miami. I want to thank Little Havana. Oh, Havana, we love. Do we love it?
Are you the president or a Miami cabaret owner? Little Havana, do we love it? It's amazing. It's gorgeous. Now, are you ready for the Buena Vista Social Club? Trump was clearly thrilled to be among supporters in Florida, and not only because they were supporters, but because they gave Trump one thing he's been dropping hints about all week. Finally, someone sang happy birthday to this 71-year-old man.
And thank you. Don't remind me. Thank you.
Look at how happy he is. If he could pass any law he wanted, it would be for double birthdays. I think we could get through the next 4 years unscathed if we just sing happy birthday to him every morning. I'm gonna bomb North. Oh, wait, hold on. They're singing happy birthday. Of course, Trump's agenda has been largely stymied by the constant Russia revelations. In fact, he's now so desperate for accomplishments, he's bragging about things the government did over a century ago. Like today, when he met with the president of Panama and touted the Panama Canal, which the U.S. finished building in 1914, leaving the president of Panama somewhat bewildered. Watch what he says under his breath.
We have many things to discuss. We're going to spend quite a bit of time today. The Panama Canal is doing quite well. I think we did a good job building it, right?
Yeah.
We did a very good job. Yeah.
One hundred years ago, yeah. Did you not get my thank you card? There's a good chance someone on Trump's team told him we just finished building it. And in fact, I did most of the digging myself. See, there we go, just like that. Here I go. Canal done. Of course, Trump is desperate to talk about anything other than the investigation, which has escalated so quickly that it seems like almost everyone around Trump is lawyering up.
The president got a lawyer. The vice president just got a lawyer yesterday. The president's own lawyer, outside lawyer, Michael Cohen, just got a lawyer.
Donald Trump's lawyer has gotten a lawyer.
Things are so bad, Trump's lawyers have their own lawyers now. He's got layers and layers of lawyers. And you need layers of lawyers when you're a liar. In fact, the investigation seems to be intensifying so rapidly that it's now reportedly widening to include Trump's family, with the Washington Post reporting that the special counsel is investigating Jared Kushner's business dealings. Now, Kushner has been such a secretive presence in the White House, best known for silently lurking behind Trump in meetings, that the administration apparently made the decision to get him in front of the cameras during a meeting with tech CEOs today. And for most people, this is the first time they got to hear what Kushner's voice sounded like. Would it be a quiet, Rasputin-like whisper or a darker, worm-tongue-like growl? Just how intimidating is Washington's newest power player?
Today, we've assembled a very impressive group of leaders from the private sector. This is Technology Week here at the White House. Together, we have set ambitious goals and empowered interagency teams to tackle our objectives. It's working, and it's very exciting.
So that's the mastermind who tried to set up a secret back channel with the Russians?
Yeah, hi, my father-in-law wants to talk with Vladimir Putin. He wants a back channel. He wants to talk so the FBI can't listen to the conversation.
He looks like he should be standing behind a podium made from cardboard. His title says senior advisor to the president, but his voice says senior at Claremont High School. So the investigation seems to be moving quickly, and Trump himself has reportedly become so transfixed by the investigation that he often insists, out of nowhere, that he did nothing wrong. According to Politico, during conversations with associates and allies, he has sometimes, without prompting, injected, "I'm not under investigation." You know, like innocent people do. This is a great date. What do you say we go back to my place? I'm not a murderer. Now, with his legal issues, Trump's staff has been trying to keep him from saying crazy things online. After it was reported last week that Trump is now personally under investigation for obstruction of justice, a senior administration official was asked what the White House game plan would be and replied, quote, "Keep him away from Twitter. Dear God, keep him away from Twitter." Trump's aides are starting to sound like frontier farmers praying for rain. Oh, please, dear God, we need this barley, something awful. Of course, that plan did not work because on Friday, Trump had another outburst on Twitter. Now, remember, Trump eventually admitted that he fired former FBI Director James Comey because of the Russia investigation. But at first, his team claimed the move was based on a recommendation from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the same guy who later appointed Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Of course, Trump ignored all that backstory and tweeted on Friday, "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director, witch hunt." Yeah, Trump's being investigated by the guy who decided to fire Comey. Who was that guy anyway?
I was going to fire Comey. My decision.
Oh, my God. So he's both the hunted and the hunter. But at the very least, this tweet finally gives us some clarity. The president has now confirmed publicly that he's under investigation. And if there's one thing the Trump White House has been consistent on until now, it's that the president's tweets need no explanation.
The president's tweets speak for themselves. The president's tweet speaks very clearly for itself. The president's tweets stand for themselves. The tweet speaks for itself. The tweet speaks for itself. His tweets do speak for themselves.
So we've been told the president's tweets speak for themselves, and they should. They are the president's words, written by the president, with no interference from anyone else. If an official White House statement is milk at a grocery store, Donald Trump's Twitter feed is the actual udder. And I imagine he tweets with the forcefulness of someone milking a cow. "I am under investigation." Send. And yet a member of Trump's legal team, Jay Sekulow, made the rounds on the Sunday shows and tried to act if the president had not said what he said, resulting in the bizarre spectacle of news anchors trying to square Sekulow's claim that the president is not under investigation with Trump's own tweet that he is under investigation. First up, Jake Tapper.
Should we take that tweet from the president as confirmation that the president is under investigation?
Let me be clear, the president's not under investigation.
So the president said, I am under investigation, even though he isn't under investigation?
The president is not under investigation. The president issued that tweet, that social media statement, based on a fake report, a report with no documented sources from the Washington Post.
Look at Tapper's face. He looks like he's staring at one of those magic eye posters. I don't see a sailboat. And then there was Fox News anchor Chris Wallace, who was baffled when Sekulo admitted that the president is under investigation, only to immediately contradict himself.
The president has not been notified by anyone that he's under investigation. So he's being investigated for taking the action that the attorney general, deputy attorney general, recommended him to take.
First of all, you've now said that he is being investigated after saying that you didn't.
No.
You just said,
no,
sir,
that he's being,
you said he is being investigated, and it's not
Chris,
just being. And,
he is,
and, wait a minute,
just,
wait a minute,
no,
Jay.
Chris,
you don't know whether he's under.
Notified.
You don't know whether
no
he's under investigation.
He
you don't know whether he's under
Chris,
investigation
like,
or not.
The president can't be indicted under the Constitution for the activities alleged in something like this. Of course not.
Why is that?
Because there's not an investigation, and there's.
Well, you don't know whether there's
president.
Oh boy, this is weird.
I don't know about you guys, but I hate it when guys with the same haircut and glasses fight. He's being investigated, so he's under investigation. Stop putting words in my mouth! So everyone around Trump is lawyering up. His staff can't stop him from freaking out on Twitter, and he can't seem to agree with his own legal team about whether he's under investigation. D.C. may not be much fun for Trump right now, but at least he'll always have...
Havana!
This has been A Closer Look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Welcome back, everybody. Our guest is a journalist whose writing has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Elle, and Spin. Her new book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth, and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001-2011, is on stands now. Please welcome to the show our friend Lizzie Goodman, everybody. How are you?
I'm great.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Me too.
This book is fantastic.
Thank
it took you 6 years.
Yeah, give or take.
6 years, and you basically had to collect interviews from everybody who was sort of essential to this 2001-2011 period.
Yeah.
And you, one of the things you've said as far as getting the idea for this book is that it began where it ended. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there were the sort of culmination of the book is these two shows at Madison Square Garden in 2011. The Strokes played and LCD Sound System played what was then considered their final show, so-called. Very happy that they're back. But... and I attended both of them, and I sort of had this moment at either right after or kind of in the midst of being at those shows where I was like, wait a second. Like, these are bands that were my peers, so to speak, or kind of, not that I knew them personally necessarily exactly, but sort of a sense of these are my people and they were our bands.
Yeah, like their youth sort of was parallel with yours.
Yeah.
And
but they were like grown-up rock stars,
right?
On big stages, and that was something else.
Well, you see. So the Strokes sort of become one of the thrusts of this story,
yeah.
And how they came about in a time where there really wasn't much of what was considered New York music, as there had been in other eras. Did you decide going into it that the Strokes would be as important, or did you kind of find your way to that during the interviews?
I mean, it was really like I knew they were important, but. I kind of went in thinking, let's see how this plays out in terms of what people tell me. And it was every single artist I spoke to, some of them grudgingly, some of them celebratorily, which is not a word, but it's fine, were like, okay, it all started with the Strokes. Or they would be like, it all started with the Strokes. But either way, there was sort of this consensus that the Strokes' success paved the way for everything that you read about in the book that came after that. And as you say, paved the way for sort of reinventing guitar music in New York City, but also globally.
And, you know, obviously the trick to the book like this is unless you get almost everybody to participate, it will feel sort of thin and empty. So where did you start to get, because, you know, you sort of have everybody You know, everybody from the Strokes, everybody in the IAS, you have LCD sound system, you have all these people. How did you convince them
Thank God.
Get involved?
Yeah, I know. Even hearing you say it would be thin and empty, I still feel this sort of, like, latent panic of, like, I know! Like, please, God, don't let that happen. I mean, I think it's just hubris, right? Like, you sort of start saying, I'm going to do this, and that's crazy, but it's fine. I'll just get them all to talk to me, and then you do. I mean, I think in this case, it's like, There's a kind of behind the scene executive producer cast of people who helped make introductions, tell other managers that I wasn't a crazy person, like sort of vouched for me to people. Ryan Gentles, the Strokes manager, who's a big character in the book as well. My friend Imran, who signed Vampire Weekend and was kind of the English counterpart for that work. Like, these are friends that I basically called like every other day going, please, can you just introduce?
So even then, though, you get the interviews. How do you, you've gotten such interesting stories where people, do you think people immediately opened up or do you think it happened over time? How did you get people to give their take on things that happened?
There's two kinds of, there's loosely two kinds of character for this book. It was like either people that really didn't want to do it, and I sort of boxed them in to say, by saying like, hey, this is not like regular journalism. It's an oral history. I just need a few quotes from you. Like, tell me anything you want about New York City between 2001 and 2011. But then when they realize that other people are saying more, perhaps, like either their bandmates or friends or whatever, that kind of elicits more. Or there are the people that are just your dream interviews, and there were a lot of them, I have to say, who just kind of sat down and were like, all right, game on. You're doing a book about this era. Like, what do you want to know?
The really lovely thing is these bands were so cool.
Yeah.
And sometimes you think that cool people are maybe not going to be kind or warm people. There's so much warmth from all these people. I feel not just the way they feel about their fellow bandmates, but the way they feel about the audience, the way they feel about the city. Because again, you know, 9/11 is a sort of a big moment in this book as well, that this music sort of started right after that. We both lived here for this entire period.
Yes.
I don't know. I both felt nostalgic for the music, and I felt like I'd completely missed out on being here for 10 years. And, and other than the fact that some of these bands would come through SNL and I would get to meet them there, like, I did not, I felt like I missed my opportunity to take advantage of the scene. Do you look back on those 10 years and say, oh, I really took advantage of being part of this world?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's, it's, yeah, it's sort of like you have the hangovers to prove it. I think. I mean, and I'm sort of surprised no one has asked me that. I did feel like I actually lived it to the extent that I wanted to. I mean, I think that's an important distinction. Like, you'll hear one of the themes in the book is this moment in certain characters' lives where it's like, I had to kind of back off at this stage. Like, I definitely had that moment, too.
But, I should note that there's, you know, warmth and kindness and all those things I said. There's also great stories about people taking way too many drugs.
Yes, so. And being mean to each other.
Yeah,
and
there's, like, it's not know. Just...
But it's now they're all very loving.
Well, it's that is the reflective... And it's interesting, too, because, you know, this is not... you know, this isn't 100 years ago. Did you think you were taking on something that was too recent history?
I didn't, but a lot of other people did.
Yeah.
That was a big concern when we were shopping the book at the beginning. Obviously, when I was trying to sell it, it was like right out. I mean, these shows, I don't know, I was selling it in 2012.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, what? Is this a magazine feature? Or, you know, I mean, there was sort of a sense of it's too soon. But I think, basically, I think in a post-internet world, it's almost never too soon.
Yeah. And also, if you're going to talk to people who partied super hard, it's best to get them while their memories are locked in.
Yeah. No, for real.
Yeah.
And the number one comment, in addition to, like, yeah, okay, the stroke started it all, was, I don't remember anything, so there's no point in you talking to me. And it's like, oh, I'll be the judge of that. But there, I did. And in some cases, people really... But that's also what's fun about oral histories. It's like, then, great, we'll have disagreement. Because the truth is, nobody... It's Rashomon, right? Like, nobody remembers anything, ever.
My favorite moment in the book is two members of Kings of Leon remember the same thing that someone said to a member of Interpol, but there's slightly different versions of it. Like, one they call somebody a vampire-looking mother... And then another guy remembers it as, like, a mortician-looking mother... You're like,
distinction.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction. Yes. But you're kind of like, oh, that is a really nice version of how you can remember. They're both kind of right, but it's nice that.
And the collective memory is so much richer than any individual. You know, I mean.
And there's, I mean, again, you know, not just getting the interviews, but it must have been so exciting, that puzzle piece of which you do so wonderfully in the book, is someone will say, I really think if you talk to this person, they would say that we are super cool now, and despite our difference in the past, you know, that we did great work. And then you hear the next person you have is that guy being like, I hate him. I still hate him. I'm always going to hate him.
Yeah. Why'd you talk to him?
Why would you ever talk to him?
He shouldn't even be in this book, and let me tell you why. And here's 20 quotes from that. Yes. There was a lot of, I mean, that is really the puzzle of it. Like, once you get going, the beginning is really hard because you just don't have anything to work with. So it sort of feels like you have to cast this super wide net with your interviews, but you also have to start to try to hone in on specific scenes that you're going to ask other people about, like, days, not scenes like rock scenes, like moments in time that you'll help hang these, build anecdotes around to make the book work. But after it starts to get moving, that part is really fun because, yeah, you're sort of sitting there going, that's not what he said.
Yeah.
But anyway, tell me more.
Well, it's really wonderful. And again, it was a time that was really important to me, and it was so wonderful to have somebody who was important to put this much effort into it. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. Thanks so much for being here,
Thank
Lizzie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lizzie Goodman, everybody. Meet Me in the Bathroom. Rebirth of Rock and Roll is on New York City. In New York City, it's on Stands Now.
Hi, everybody. This is Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with Lizzie Goodman, author of Meet Me in the Bathroom, backstage after her interview with Seth. So I think one of the most interesting parts of the book was there was a quote about eras of music as a response to their previous era. And when we talked, you said it's not solely about the music, it's also about how the industry is responding. How do you think that kind of manifested during this time in the early 2000s?
Yeah, I think every musical scene is a response to the culture that births it. So in this case, you just had so much sort of tumultuous change going on at the same time in New York City, 9/11, Napster, the kind of the gentrification of Manhattan at that time, and then eventually it would jump to Brooklyn. And I think all of those factors are sort of the backdrop against which these bands are, you know, maybe not consciously at the time, but finding their sound. And certainly it's the backdrop against which the people who are going to consume these artists are finding their sound, or their, you know, sort of heroes, musical heroes. And then just as importantly, because at the end of the day, this is a business and we don't know about any of this stuff if there aren't, you know, labels or, you know, radio stations or whatever playing them, it shapes how the industry chooses what to pay attention to, what to put resources into promoting.
So as you said, during this time, Brooklyn as a borough drastically changed, and you delve into it there, you look at it sort of as like an export from New York, like an entity that doesn't belong to New York anymore. And there was that quote that we talked about trucker hats and homemade beer in mason jars, but that one of your friends had actually seen that in Paris.
Yes. So I think, you know, one of the things that you see happen in is a kind of condensing of the idea of New York City into this amorphous thing that can live anywhere. So, I mean, it's still physical, like it's being manifest in a real way. In this case, it's my friend Andy Greenwald talking about going into a restaurant in Paris and just going, wait a second, like this is Brooklyn, but it's not one particular corner in Brooklyn. It's like Williamsburg, but also like it's hamburgers. So it's like American hamburger, but it's like hamburger culture, but it's also like Momofuku. Like, okay, it's just this synthesis of everything that has the kind of signifier of New York, but it's not even New York like Manhattan, New York anymore. John Lennon wearing the t-shirt, New York City, it's Brooklyn. And Brooklyn is even more, I mean, I think New York has always been an exportable idea, but Brooklyn is even more that, and even more reflective of a kind of post-internet version of that, in that it is a hybrid.
Right.
It's like a hybrid idea of New York.
Right. And you said also that as Brooklyn became this place because of the gentrification and the rezoning that happened in New York City due to all those laws and Mayor Giuliani coming in, that Brooklyn became that place because of that. And James Murphy had that quote about Brooklyn being your
Yeah,
their
this
fault.
Isn't in the book, but James, I was sort of, I didn't know him when I first interviewed him at all, and I was not sure what to expect. And I was kind of trying to ease my way into basically bringing up this idea, like, you know, Brooklyn's kind of terrible and sort of like it's because of this sort of reinvention of culture that you guys and these other bands I'm talking to helped popularize. And I sort of was easing my way into it in probably a not very elegant way. And he just stopped me and goes, oh, yeah, that's our fault. And I was like, great. Guess we're on the same page. I mean, I think there is this sense that you, but again, and he was eager to say this, and I would be remiss if I didn't note that he said this, and I also feel this way. That's the game. Like, it's not, he wasn't saying it in a bitchy way where it's sort of like old grandpa complaining about the young kids who stole his thing. And then, I mean, that's not how he sees it at all. It's like, this is the natural life cycle of trend. And all anyone can ever hope for is to kind of be part of the ground floor of something that ignites in a way that people want to copy it and then dilute it and then sell it as a package idea in like kiosks in European cities, right? To tourists, right? You know?
And I think one of the other, fun stories that you tell in the book is the story of Plant Bar and how when all of these rezoning things were happening and the city was changing, how certain DJs had specific music that they put on to obey the laws.
That would be OK Computer.
Right.
Yeah. In Plant Bar, when they wanted, they had, I mean, it is hilarious. It was very narrow. And they wanted, so the DJ would be at the very back. And I mean, no one should be DJing in this space. It was like a closet. It was like not built for any of this, but they had this huge sound system. And it was illegal to dance. This is Giuliani, these sort of draconian, like basically racist, like jazz era laws in New York were still in the books. And Giuliani and then later Bloomberg was using them to kind of close down nightlife culture in order to clean up the city, basically. Mm-hmm. And so when the police, the like noise cops would come by, the bouncer or someone at the front or maybe the bartender would hit a light and it would go on in the DJ booth and it would be like, play OK Computer to make everyone stop dancing, which is like so funny because it's such a great record, but maybe not so danceable. I mean, right. I see where they're going with this. So it was the kind of like chill out buzzkill at the Plant Bar scene.
And it worked.
It worked. Until they got shut down.
Right. Until it closed forever.
Until it closed forever.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We loved having you.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.